Sometime between the innocence of childhood and the excitement of the teenage years lurks a phase of life so awkward, so confusing, so terrifying that some people are still telling their therapists about it. Mark Jude Poirier has just edited an anthology of stories about adolescence called The Worst Years of Your Life, published by Simon & Schuster Trade Paperbacks. He's here today with two of the book's contributors, A.M. Holmes and Victor D. Laval. And later on, we will invite your calls and emails about the worst years of your life. But right now, I'm pleased to welcome Mark Jude Poirier, A.M. Holmes, and Victor Laval to the show. Hello.
Thank you.
Mark, your book includes a famous story by John Barth called Lost in the Funhouse, in which Barth writes, "Is there anything more tiresome than in fiction than the problems of sensitive adolescence?" I suspect he wrote that because he was reacting to the popularity of Catcher in the Rye. But that's an odd way to an odd thing to include in a book in which we're talking about the agonies of adolescence.
Well, the irony is that his story is about that. When I conceived of this anthology, that was the first story that popped into my head. Mm-hmm. Because not only is it about the worst years of your life, it is it's terribly innovative and all that as well.
Well, that was a kind of
and he was my professor, so I had to.
What makes those few years of adolescence the worst of many people's lives? Because I guess there are a few people out there who say, wait a minute, I had a great time when I was that age.
Well, I mean, it depends on what you mean by that age. You know, I think a lot of people had a great time as teenagers, you know, from 16 on maybe. But it's those horrible years maybe, you know, and it's different for boys and girls, I think. Maybe from 11 to 15, puberty.
Mm-hmm. Well, voices are changing.
Voices are changing, you know, bodies are changing.
What? Moods are changing.
Moods are changing.
Well, the brain is actually remaking itself, I gather. That's what scientists are saying. It's reshaping itself during that time.
So you're expected to exist while your brain is reshaping itself.
Amy, go ahead.
I think it also just prompts an identity crisis. So it's one of the first times when you're somehow expected to, in a vaguely adult format, assert who you are or who you will be. And there's so many shifts going on at that time that it's hard to know. And then once you assert one version, people kind of want to hold you to it. So 3 weeks later, when the next version, and you change the spelling of your name, you know, comes up, people then say, well, last week, you know, you were Victor with a K. Uh-huh. So it's just a delicate balance that is perpetually, I think, an imbalance.
Tell us about your contribution to this collection, A Real Doll.
Well, curiously, it was written shortly after adolescence. I wrote it at Iowa when I was in the graduate writing program there, and I wanted to write an innocent story about a boy dating a Barbie doll because I thought, here's this cultural icon. And I went to the store and I bought a Barbie thinking I ought to have one in hand. And it was called My First Barbie, and it was my first Barbie. It may have well been dubbed Virgin Barbie because it was had bigger buttons and was easier to dress and undress. And I put it on the mantelpiece in Iowa, and all of the students in the Iowa writing program came in, you know, not all at once. But curiously, everybody undressed her. Men undressed her, women undressed her, and they all started confessing things. That was that their sisters, you know, put pins in her head for earrings, or that they used to sort of, you know, have peculiar sort of sex relationships with her. Just one more thing after another, and it became so incredibly dark that the story I wrote really was about both our expectations of Barbie and also how she was viewed by both young men and young women, which was sort of different from what other people had talked about.
Well, the girl in the story likes to mutilate her doll, which seems pretty common.
It's apparently
it's a love-hate relationship.
It is. It's absolutely a love-hate relationship. And then the brother, the older brother, also sort of develops his own version of a love-hate relationship with her as well.
Yeah, which we are not going to go into any detail about. But do you think that they have those same experiences with the Ken dolls?
Well, I think so, yeah. I think that there's always been a lot of speculation about Ken.
Do people undress Ken as well?
Well, they undress Ken, and Ken is different from some other male dolls. And, you know, there used to be, I don't know what he's got now, but at one point there was always a kind of a sort of dotted outline of where his underwear would be, or just a change in a funny way, a change in skin texture is what some of the doll companies use to outline what would be the private areas. It's fascinating what goes on at the 11.5-inch scale.
Victor, what ideas pop into your mind when we talk about adolescence?
Metallica, frankly, and sitting in a basement being one of the only weird black kids who loved Metallica and Iron Maiden in this neighborhood where it was all Public Enemy and who else at the time? And EPMD or something like that.
Do you have any idea why?
Because before we moved to this black neighborhood, we were living in Flushing, which was this mixed neighborhood, mostly whites. It was all these immigrant kids wearing Slayer T-shirts. Mm-hmm. And then we moved, and then suddenly I was a nut.
And which is the equivalent of changing the spelling of your name
from
a C to a K, isn't it?
Exactly.
So tell us about your story, Class Trip, which is really about what happens with adolescent boys and the way they bond with each other, kind of.
Yes. I mean, I wrote it when I was doing my MFA program, and I kind of wanted to write about, so I wasn't that far removed from that time, maybe a 10 years, something like that, 7 years. And I wanted to write about this thing that me and my friends used to do that I remembered very fondly, which was going down to the West Side Highway, down around like 20th or so, and just walking, braving the long line of prostitutes who used to just pick up suburban men who would pull over and meet them. And for us, it was the strangest thing in the world to actually be on foot there walking by. And we would just scream things at the men in the cars. We would say things to the women and pretend we had enough money for even a smile, which we didn't.
So this is kind of working out your attitudes about male-female relationships.
Yes, and also just seeing how brave
in a really
we might
screwed
be.
Up way.
In a screwed up, yeah. But at the same time, but I really wanted to write it as a sort of a, because the character in the story has a girlfriend at home who he's trying to stay loyal to, but he and his friends are like, we're gonna go meet a woman this time and have something done, and his battle is whether he should stay loyal or not. But really, I wanted it to be this love story between the guys. That in a strange way, this was an act of affection.
Well, the New York in the story is a dark, menacing place. Is that a metaphor, or is that, was that your sense of the city when you were growing up?
Well, I honestly, like, I know it's often the things that are in the story and some of the other stories in that collection are pretty unpleasant, but I really thought of New York back then. I don't necessarily wish for it now, but I thought it was great. You know, I mean, I could just walk into very strange places in Times Square when I was 12, and no one batted an eye, and it was quite an education in its way. So I liked it.
Mark, did your story, Thunderbird, draw on your own experiences?
Yeah, I think you can probably gather that if you read the introduction, too. It definitely did. I mean, it's growing up in Tucson, which was sort of a... at the time, in the early 80s, it was just expanding at, like, you know, an acre a minute or something ridiculous like that. And it was just such a place without a soul.
But a lot of heat.
But a lot of heat, yeah. And
I like Tucson, actually.
I love Tucson.
But it gets too hot for a New Yorker.
Yeah, well, you know, I actually love it during the summer because the town empties out and you can just sort of, you know, drive anywhere without traffic or whatever.
Just you and the cactus.
Yeah, yeah. But it was kind of a strange place for me. We had moved there from outside of Boston around this time in my life. And, you know, it was video games. It was masturbation. It was just like I feel like the worst years of my life were wasted years, you know? I wish that I had read more. I wish that I had studied more.
Today you could be playing video games all day long.
Exactly.
But did you develop a new perspective on your own adolescence while you were working as an eighth grade teacher?
I definitely did as an eighth grade teacher. I think, you know, I was just complaining a few minutes ago about how they were wasted years, but there was something beautiful in my imaginary life going on at that time. And I think by teaching the eighth graders, I could see that these kids weren't all just hormones and all that, that they all probably had their own imaginary world.
Do you think this is the period where we start developing different kinds of imaginary worlds? As kids, we can play with dolls and stuff like that, but then we start imagining ourselves as perhaps becoming adults on some level, or working things out, or having falling in love and doing all the other things that would have really made us think feel all icky when we were a little younger.
I think you just said it, which is that I think that as adolescents we start imagining ourselves in other roles. And earlier in life, we imagine ourselves either in, you know, other sort of childhood roles or in kind of fairy tale roles or in sort of pre-existing made-up things. But as an adolescent, you really begin imagining yourself as someone who will go forward into the world and what you might be capable of doing. And I think that's both thrilling and scary, and it's also the one time where I think in some way you're most yourself. You're most classically and inescapably yourself because you haven't yet learned how to kind of shield yourself from the world and the world from you in those ways. It's kind of what's part of what's so ugly about adolescence, but also so compellingly beautiful about it, is that you can't escape the sort of raw explosion of self.
Well, you've written a lot about adolescence over the years, so this is a period that really fascinates you.
It is, and I think it's one that in many cases, as writers, is not all that well explored. People have tended to write novels and short stories in which children or adolescents are sort of byproducts of an adult story, but not so much a story that is, for lack of a word, for adults, but about that period of time, or that doesn't minimize the adolescence kind of struggle.
My guests are A.M. Holmes, Victor Laval, and also Marc Jude Poirier. We're talking about adolescence. In this case, they are all contributors, and one is also the editor of a book called The Worst Years of Your Life, published by Simon & Schuster Paperback. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate, and in a little while we invite your calls. In fact, you can start calling us now at 212-433-9692 with your thoughts about adolescence. Victor, you've also written a lot about adolescence. In fact, you've written both short stories and a novel that deal with that period. Why that period? Is that the key to everything that follows?
Well, I think one of the things that's interesting about that period is you haven't also developed a perspective yet in any way. And so the things that, like, when you get to this age, say you get in a relationship and it doesn't work out, and you can say, I understand things are going to change, you know, I'll find someone else. But at that age, it really does seem like, you know, life has come to an end because whoever won't take my hand in the parking lot or whatever.
This is, it's almost like, this is the only relationship I'll ever have in
yes.
my life.
And this is the only everything that happens that I'll ever have in my life. And so it is fascinating for exactly the reasons that A.M. said before, was just like, you know, you're like a sun or something. You're just burning, burning, burning constantly.
But there's another factor, isn't there? Writers fear rejection and worry what other people will say about them, worry if they'll be misunderstood. And I wonder if there's a little bit of residual adolescent angst in every writer.
Yes, there is.
I think of it as not residual and not adolescent, but there's certainly an enormous amount of angst in every writer. I mean, I think that's what we spend our days doing, is just sort of going through the angst chest and seeing, you know, what's fresh today.
So is it cathartic to write about adolescence and remember when things were even worse than they are now?
I think for me, honestly, if I really wrote the true story of my adolescence, it would be so incredibly gruesome I couldn't begin to, you know, my fiction makes it look pretty, which is kind of extreme coming from me.
And now you're scaring me.
Yeah. I know. I think back on it, I think I was not like the worst adolescent. I didn't hardly get arrested or anything, but it was pretty bad. I dropped out of 10th grade and just stayed home for a year writing really bad poems that I would write in longhand and then give my mother to type, and they were all like, I wish I was dead. I really, really wish I was dead.
Actually, that's the period where people start writing those kinds of very personal things. Yeah. And maybe
Absolutely.
That's another reason we find it so fascinating, because it's the time when we're starting to try to figure out what things are all about.
I think because I didn't start writing fiction until I was 23 or something, maybe that I'm trying to work through all that time when I should have been writing bad poems when I was 15.
I didn't say they were bad.
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, you did.
Now, the majority of the stories in this collection don't focus on sex, but all three of you have written stories that revolve around it. Is that just a coincidence that you're the three who wound up coming on the show today?
I think that in some way writing about sex is, you know, an inescapable part of writing, and it's certainly an inescapable part of writing or talking about adolescence, because it's when people sort of first are testing out those desires and those parts of themselves with any degree of kind of articulation, for lack of a better word.
You were talking earlier about imaginary worlds. And one of the things that happens at this time in your life is that your imaginary world, it becomes sexualized. And it becomes such a huge part of who you are that it's inescapable.
And before then, whether we're straight or gay, we don't think much about it. And suddenly at adolescence, we start thinking all about who we are and what we want and who interests us and who attracts us. And also what other people will think about us if we talk about those things. Our number, 212-433-9692. My guests are three contributors to a book called The Worst Years of Your Life. And we invite you to join in on the conversation. Our number, 212-433-9692. Put on the headphones so you can hear our listeners. We go to Dana from, is it Florham Park?
Yeah, that's right.
Never heard of it.
F-L-O-R-U-M? F-L-O-R-H-A-M.
Oh, Florham. Okay. Never heard of it anyway. what do you want to talk about?
I think adolescence really is a period of time also where you're developing a point of view and opinions of the world and deciding on how you're going to approach the world and what's in it.
Do you think it's different today because so many kids are playing computer, well, working on computers and playing computer games? We had to busy ourselves with a lot of different kinds of things when we were younger.
Yes and no. I think it depends on the kid. I mean, I think of myself. I grew up, I was 12, 13 in the early 70s, and I was very influenced by the women's movement at that time, and I continue to carry that through my adulthood. And I see my own son, who is now 18, who was around 12 or 13 when 9/11 happened, and his view of the world and his opinions of the world really were shaped, I would say, by that one event.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's how aware they are of what's going on in the world and just even becoming aware of what's going on in the world.
Thank you so much for calling us. Anybody want to add anything to that?
You know, I think one of the things I've noticed, which may be different both time-wise and also place-wise, is I grew up in suburbia just outside of Washington, D.C., and I'm now raising a child here in New York City. And at the moment, I would swear adolescence starts at about 3.5. and I don't know if it's really changed or really that accelerated, but just the awareness of a kid living in a city of people and things and shopping and things that I think in a way I was certainly, you know, much more oblivious to, although I was a good shoplifter as a kid. you know, it is very different. And I think there is a kind of acceleration to adolescence, which kind of pressurizes it all the more in some way.
Although, you know, what's also interesting with that is dealing sometimes with kids who are 15, 16 now, even 14, who go to like city schools and some things that I've done with them, and where you might see them on a train and they're wearing like a belly shirt and tight pants and all this stuff, and they look like grown, at least the women look like grown women. The men are tall enough to be grown men. But the interesting thing is if you scratch them a little bit and you put them in situations that are a little frightening or unfamiliar, they let you know that they're only 14, that they're still children, and that in a sense that part of it doesn't seem like it changes. At least maybe, I don't know, American youth, that's the most I can speak of.
I agree with you. When I taught 8th grade, I also taught 9th grade for a year. It is that. The young women look like, as I say in the introduction, they look like sorority girls. Mm-hmm. You know, they look like they're 19 through 23, but they're 12 through 14.
Yeah.
But, like you said, if you scratch them a little bit, you'll see that they're still 13 or 12.
Yeah. Bob from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi. You were talking about kids imagining the future, and one of the things we all stumble with is the concept that our parents have a sex life. coincidentally, my oldest was maturing just about the time of the Monica Lewinsky scandal, and the president and I were exact contemporaries, the same age. And I had to sort of smile to think that, you know, he was taking the role of, you know, proving the fact that, you know, a 50-year-old man in his mid-50s was having sex, and sort of took a little bit of the burden off me.
Thank you for calling us. I think that's for the next collection. What do you think? My guests are Mark Jude Poirier, the editor and one of the contributors to The Worst Years of Your Life, which is published by Simon & Schuster Paperback. Also here are two of the contributors, and it's a wonderful group of contributors, Nathan Englander, Kevin Canty, who else is here? Jennifer Egan, John Barth, as we said, Stanley Elkin, Jim Shepard, Alicia Arian, and A.M. Holmes and Victor D. Laval, who are in the studio with us, and we're taking your calls at 212-433-9692. We'll be back with more of your calls right after this. And we're back with Mark Jude Poirier, the editor of The Worst Years of Your Life, which is published by Simon & Schuster Paperbacks. He's also one of the contributors, and two of the other contributors are here, A.M. Holmes and Victor D. Laval. And we are taking your calls at 212-433-9692. Julie from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the Leonard Lopate Show.
Hello. It's just a comment. I'm 69. At 14, I told myself I would commit suicide at 21 because life would be horrible after 21. And looking at adults, I thought, I don't want to be like that. Anyway, I guess I changed my mind.
And here you are. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
But yeah, it is a time when kids think a lot about suicide, don't they?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And it's also, I mean, it goes back to even, you know, the Who song, My Generation. In some ways, none of this is new, but I think things like teen suicide have certainly escalated over the years. I don't know that it was as much a phenomenon in the 40s and 50s. As expectations, I think, have risen in some ways.
Do you think that kids reading Catcher in the Rye have the same kind of response today that they did in the past?
Well, you know, what interests me about that is I feel like kids read it at a younger age. We read it in junior high school, and I think people are reading it now, like in sixth grade or something. So it may be that it's a different book in a different time.
I mean, they're just killing time waiting for the next Harry Potter to come out. Now what are they going to do?
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
But that feeds into the whole idea that kids are growing up earlier, but I'm not sure that's true.
No. But you also have I wonder sometimes, is it also that I remember Catcher in the Rye was supposed to have been so disturbing when it came out. Holden Caulfield was this awful kid who spoke in this awful language, and maybe it's also just that it's sort of like aged down, so by fourth or fifth grade, kids are ready for whatever he has to say in there, and they need something a little harder.
I had problems with, I don't know about you, Victor, but I grew up in Williamsburg, in a very poor part of Williamsburg, not the hip bohemian part. And when I read Catcher in the Rye, I thought, this is about a kid whose experiences had nothing to do with my experiences. Mm-hmm. This is a rich kid. What the heck is he complaining about? He doesn't know just how tough it can be out there.
I taught a Salinger course at Bennington College when I was teaching there. And this is probably unfair to say, but many of the kids at Bennington College come from privileged lives. A lot of them were sort of savvy enough to see, like, this story doesn't really pertain to the vast majority of the country, you know?
And yet it was so iconic for so many people.
And it still is. And it still
I think in its root, it was sort of about an existential crisis, which was, you know, who was a phony and who was not, and what was real. And I think that's definitely something that even teenagers right now, looking at the world around us and looking at our government and our history and say, you know, what is real and what can I expect of myself and of the country I live in, really is very much still an issue. But the setup for it is very different these days, I think.
I made that argument to my students, and their response was, well, you have to be rich to have the opportunity to have an existential crisis.
Whoa.
Because otherwise you're too busy.
No wonder I've been denied my existential crisis.
You got to play to win.
David from Glen Ridge, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Interesting, when I read, I'm 54, when I read Catcher in the Rye, before it was assigned, I guess it was probably seventh grade, and I was so oblivious in those years that I didn't know what it was all about. And I wanted to be Holden Caulfield. I had no idea. I didn't understand the ending at all. missed the point of it, and was chastised actually for not getting it. But in any event, I wanted to add to the discussion that I've got a daughter who's turning 13 soon, and is so much more sophisticated, not necessarily much more mature, but much more sophisticated than I was when I was her age. They were not the worst years of my life by any means. In fact, I just played baseball and sports throughout, and like I said, remained pretty much oblivious to any problems in the house or whatever. But my question to throw out there is the concept of this being potentially the worst years of someone's life, I think girls, is terrifying to a parent. Mm-hmm. And I find myself thinking a lot about what do I keep this from being the worst years of her life.
And can you protect your kid from having those problems? I suspect you can't.
Well, I would think as a kid, at least for me, my mom tried to be very protective, but I sought out the worst things I could find and the most dangerous things I could find because they were the most fun things, and you wanted to test yourself against hard things as a kid.
So, well, boys did anyway.
There were a lot of girls who were doing exactly the same thing, I got to say.
Acting out.
I mean, I think there's also a hope as a parent that you, early on, like, you know, when they're born, begin talking to them about, you know, what your thinking is about values, about their own sense of who they are, and that everything that another kid does is not what they have to do, and that you, by the time they get to adolescence, that they have enough of a core self that they don't have to do everything that everyone else is doing, and then they can make some choices for themselves and hopefully survive it. It is a very difficult time.
Judy, hi, you're on the air.
Oh, hi, I'm in a car, so I hope that I stay on the air. I was just wanting to make a comment about the kind of friendships you make at that time in your life. There's just something about the friends then and the rawness and kind of open emotion that goes on in those friendships that I don't know if I've really experienced since then. I wonder if you had any comments on that.
I definitely agree. My two best friends are friends that I made when I was 12 and 14.
And girls even more than boys in many instances. I know a lot of women who have remained friends with those teenage friends from junior high school.
I think it's a time in your life when you have a lot of free time. You know, as an adult, you're at work and whenever you don't have as much time to talk, you don't get to play with your CD collection, you don't get to sort of make mixtapes for your friends in those same ways. I mean, in that sense, it's also a wonderfully rich time because you can form incredibly deep and intimate relationships with people, and it's also where you really practice the skills of intimacy and of negotiation.
Is it Nathalie?
Yes, it's Nathalie.
From Hillside, New Jersey. Hi, yeah. You're on the air.
Hi. I grew up in Wisconsin, and I came from a private Catholic school right into a public high school for ninth grade, and I was very quiet and studious, and I was in a phys ed class with lots of jocks and cheerleaders, and one of them, we had a volleyball rotation. She threw the volleyball in my face and broke my glasses. And the teacher took her side. She said I should have been watching the ball. And I just cried. You know, I couldn't believe that nobody was taking my side on this. And I think my parents eventually made a complaint, but I just sat in there for hours in the locker room just crying. I couldn't get over it. And then later on in ninth grade...
Well, it's a time when fair and unfair is very important to us.
Oh, it was awful, and my advanced composition teacher showed me a way to get back at them. He put me on the staff of the newspaper, and I wrote editorials about sports being the opiate of the masses.
Well, thank you for calling us. But that is another thing. That sense of justice is really important when you're that age.
Also, kids can be incredibly cruel to each other. Yeah. I mean, they have a capacity for brutality and cruelty. I mean, you see it, you know, you look at Lord of the Flies in some ways and see it, but it's amazing, and it starts very early. And I always think, I look at my daughter and I think, they're primates. And you're just constantly trying to sort of tame them and give them skills. But I would say in some way, girls especially have this unique ability to just rip the rug out from underneath another girl and love it.
Well, it's what we were talking about earlier, how everything is so raw at this age that the meanness is raw too, and the meanness is intense. And so one minute you can be this loving individual, and the next you can, as you said, rip the rug out.
Bruce,
and love it.
Bruce from Brooklyn, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, I grew up in the 40s in sort of a tough town in the Midwest, but I knew from very early on that I was gay, and you had to kind of, you just instinctively knew you had to play the game to survive.
Bruce, you think that gay kids know they're gay younger than heterosexual kids are 100% sure they're heterosexual?
For most of the people that I've talked to, yes. I would say yes. They had certain, you know, fantasies or even movie idols and things that they were more, felt romantic about from a very early age. I'm always shocked when I talk to people and they say, oh, I can't remember past the age of 10 or 7 or something. I can remember way back, you know, but I think it was because you knew you had to walk that line. My neighborhood was very tough, and you really had to know the rules and know the boundaries. It wasn't until I think way after I got out of high school and found a more liberal set of friends that I was able to just be myself. But you know, all through school, it was you know, you were playing the game.
Did your parents know, do you think? Because I've spoken to any number of parents who've said,
I think my kid
is going to be gay, he doesn't know it yet, or she doesn't know it yet.
About that. I think a lot of parents are in denial about it, even if there are signs of it.
I come from a family of 11 kids, and I'm the gay one. And I knew since I can remember that I was gay. But the thing about this time in your life is, like, it's easy to go and play baseball and football. But at this time in your life, you have to start pretending to be interested in girls. And you have to start this whole new level of lying that consumes you. And I think that that's probably why I'm so attracted to this time in my writing.
Thank you for your call, Bruce. Jeffrey from Manhattan. Hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I just wanted to throw into the conversation the idea that, you know, adolescence as we know it today and sort of teenagerness is sort of a fairly recent historical construction. I mean, kids this age in the late 1900s, late 19th century, I mean, you know, they were off in work. They were thinking about marriage and adulthood. And this idea, this idleness of the adolescence, you know, that's sort of a recent thing of the, you know, 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s, and on up. And there's also the consumer angle on it, how they're really a demographic.
Well, but people were going through these transitions even before we called it adolescence, just like people were homosexuals before somebody came up with the name homosexual. So don't you think that it doesn't really matter whether we come up with a demographic or not?
Well, I'm just sort of throwing in the idea that, you know, expectations are very different. You know, maybe adolescents today are treated like something very different than the way children, kids, young adults, whatever we want to call them, in the 1800s, the way they were treated. You know, teenagers today and middle schoolers today they're supposed to act very differently than, say, a 14, 15, 16-year-old in the 1800s did. And that's all I wanted to say. Thanks.
You know, what's interesting to me about that, though, I think it's almost the opposite, which is that in some way we expect teenagers now to act much more like adults, and we treat them like adults in terms of their consumerism, in terms of the way we sell things to them, and in some ways what we expect of their behavior, that they are, you know, much more treated fully as citizens, whereas in the sort of 1950s and early 1960s, we treated them as adolescents or as early teenagers. And I think also as the life cycle has gotten longer, that's also part of the sort of extension of it. You know, we also talk at various times about, you know, men who are adolescents into their 50s and extended adolescence. So that's a whole other, of course, collection of stories that Mark will see.
The characters you write about, Victor, we can see, you know, grown-up versions of them, these boys.
Yeah, well, hopefully they won't be.
I've seen a few. I've known
them. Yeah, well, hopefully nowadays I have faith in them that they've grown into at least 16-year-olds, you know.
although they may still be listening to Metallica.
I hope so.
Debbie from New Jersey, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you? I'm a writer, too. The only thing I publish is for younger children, but I'm also a mother of a 13-year-old and a 21-year-old. And my question is for the writers and for everyone in general there. The baby boomer generation, so many of us had our children later in life that a lot of us now, as our children are entering adolescence or entering menopause or middle age. And my standard joke, as I was telling your screener, is I don't know who's going to get their mustache first, my son or me. And moods, with the mood swings of early menopause and the mood swings of adolescence, I'm frequently having conversations with my son that if ever I seem out of sorts or he seems out of sorts, that we can't take it personally. It's our hormones talking.
Although if he gets hot flashes, watch out.
Exactly. And you know, we joke about that. But on a technical note, with the other writers, as someone who also writes for, you know, younger people, sometimes I use my son as a, you know, a researcher. Well, I like to think I'm pretty aware of contemporary slang and, you know, the way kids are talking. You always hit that wall when you come up with a phrase and your son looks at you like a deer caught in the headlights and go, what are you talking about? We don't say those things.
We're going to have to end it here. Victor, you want to talk about that?
Well, I mean, certainly something you could do is just to become obsessively involved with MySpace and Facebook, and I guess you could...
And actually do a little research.
And do the research that way, and then pick it on up, and then surprise your son with how you know more than him.
But, you know, it's interesting. Kids do know more about our things than we know about their things, because they've lived in our world.
Yes.
And we aren't necessarily living in their world. One of the stories I was going to ask you about, but we don't have time, is by Julie Oehringer. Is it Oehringer?
Yeah.
She wrote Note to Sixth Grade Self, and maybe we all should ask ourselves, if we were sending a message to our adolescent self, what would it be? My guests have been Mark Jude Poirier, who has edited The Worst Years of Your Life, a collection of stories. It says, for the geeked out, angst-ridden, lust-addled, and deeply misunderstood adolescent in all of us. And two of the contributors to the book, A.M. Holmes and Victor D. Laval. The book is published by Simon and Schuster Paperbacks. It's been a lot of fun, and thank you all of you who have
thank
called.
Thank you very much.
Sorry we couldn't get to more calls. On tomorrow's show, baseball superstar Gary Sheffield talks about the politics of the game and why he believes so few players spend their entire careers with just one team. Then a look at some of the colorful players who played in 1908, the year modern baseball was created, plus Walter Isaacson on his best-selling biography of Albert Einstein, and surgeon Atul Gawande talks about how doctors can make sure they give their patients the best care possible. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English and Blake Neeschick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer, and we had help today from Rory Bernstein, Sophie Rand, Jennifer Keeney-Sendro, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. We'll see you tomorrow.